Okay, and we are starting with Schiffman's comment about Ezra. We finished the comment that under Persian rule, people were allowed to worship their ancestral gods and live the way that they wanted. The only thing the Persians were interested in was the political stability of the empire and the taxes, and exactly, of course, what Rome was interested in. And now Schiffman wants to move toward this next stage. The next stage is what we looked at with Peter Ackroyd, what happened after the Babylonian captivity. Remember, what we said is we don't have virtually no evidence at all about how the people acted during the captivity. But after the captivity, now we start to see biblical documents that support what happened in the history. And of course, one of those really key figures is Ezra. Okay? So Schiffman says, what this leader, teacher, and scholar did was establish the basis for the future of Judaism. From here on, the canonized Torah, the five books of Moses, would be the constitution of Jewish life. So this is really important because remember, in Ezra, they discover the scroll. Remember, they discover the scroll and read it? And the people weep because they've now reestablished their connection to the covenant God. Okay? But Ezra is the one who brings all of that into the religious community of Israel on the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and it becomes the fundamental doctrine, the fundamental constitution, the document of Judaism from that point on. Okay, there might be questions in the rabbinic community up to the second century about how the other books fit. The writings and the prophets, right? There was all kinds of discussions of what do we do with Nehemiah? What do we do with Song of Solomon, etc.? But when it comes to Moses, from this point on, absolutely no question whatsoever that Moses establishes the fundamentals of the Jewish way of life, right? So this is really, really critical. And then he says, Schiffman says, the restoration of the Second Temple allowed Israel to continue its ancestral worship of God in the ways prescribed by its ancient literature. That's Moses, of course. More importantly, it established the biblical sacrificial system as the dominant pattern of worship for the entire Second Temple period. Okay? So, what does that tell us? You can't understand what's happening in the apostolic writings in the New Testament unless you understand the fundamental position of the sacrificial system in the Second Temple period. Because Yeshua is a product of that. He is merely one man, along with all the other males in Judaism, who's practicing according to the way that Moses lays down the covenant relationship with God. If you ignore that, if you somehow, like Christianity, as Maddie said, if you somehow ignore the fact that the covenant relationship in Moses, the supposed law, is actually instruction about how the community is supposed to live. If you ignore that, if you pretend that somehow the death of Yeshua meant the end of the law, then you completely misunderstand what happens in Judaism in the Second Temple period, and that, of course, includes the first century, right? So, Schiffman continues, the returning Jews from Babylonia could not accept the questionable genealogy of the Samaritans. On the other hand, there was not yet a system of religious conversion like that developed somewhat later in the Second Temple period. Okay? So now he's talking about what happened with this, you know, we see it in the apostolic writings, the antagonism between Jews and Samaritan. What was the real problem? The real problem was the claim of the Samaritans in relation to the genealogy that brings them into covenant relationship with God versus the returning Babylonian Hebrews, okay? And since there's no system of conversion like there ultimately would be when proselytes become part of Judaism from the Hellenistic Greek world, since that system hadn't been put in place, there's only the division between Samaritans and Jews, and of course it just grows, okay? So he goes on. In the Persian period, the Judeans rejected the Samaritans due to their syncretistic worship and the presence of non-Israelite elements among their population. Okay? You can read that as in relation to Ezra. Because what does Ezra say? You got to get rid of all of your Gentile wives and their children. You can't have anything to do with even people coming to sell you goods if they come from the Gentile world, that is the Samaritan world, right? We're going to completely isolate ourselves from any influence at all from the outside world because we want to maintain this purity with God so that he never again has to punish us with captivity, okay? Ezra's fixation on the rigidity of maintaining the relationship with God through the covenant, right, becomes the standard by which Jews treat the rest of the you know, world population. They're now separate. They're now different. Okay. So he goes on, obeying the laws in the book of Deuteronomy and heeding the injunctions of the prophets, they could not accept the Samaritans. Why? Because the Samaritans didn't behave religiously in exactly the same way that Ezra understood the Torah. Okay. And now let's read the next paragraph. But the Torah had one deficiency as a legal text. There was an apparent contradictions and inconsistencies between the legal rulings and its various sections. Now something new was called for. How were the contradictions between the laws on the same subject to be handled? How were the multiple presentations of the same material to be understood? The duplications in the Torah begged to be interpreted. Thus was born the method which later Hebrew termed Midrash. Essentially, the exegetical interpretive technique of Midrash can be defined as the explanation of one biblical passage in light of another. In its earliest forms, Midrash dealt with matters of Jewish law, what the rabbis later called halakha. Okay? So here's a really critical thing happens as a result of this exclusivity and the connection to the Torah, the five books of Moses. What happens is, if you read through the five books of Moses, you will come across ambiguous passages that either look like they're contradictions with other parts of the Torah or that they're inconsistent. And now you have to have an interpretive scheme to correct all of that because the people will ask, yeah, but what are we supposed to do? Okay? And that means that post Babylon, the idea of Midrash was developed as a way to interpret the text. How? By looking at other parts of the text and reading those parts together. Now, I don't know if you've ever looked at some Jewish Midrash, but from our perspective, it's very strange because they will say things like, oh, this passage in Numbers is explained by this Psalm. Okay. Now we know the Psalm was written hundreds of years after the passage in Numbers. So how can you use the Psalms or a text from Jeremiah to interpret what happens in Numbers, right? You should, as a scholarly exegete, you should pay attention to the chronology. Just like when we look at the letters of Paul, you can't read what Paul says in Romans in order to understand what he's saying in Galatians, because Romans was the last thing that he wrote, right? So his thinking is evolving and developing between Galatia and Rome, and therefore you can't use Rome to interpret Galatians. But in fact, the rabbis do this all the time. They will say, oh, you see this difficult passage in Numbers? Well, it's really explained by this Psalm of David, okay? So what they're doing is they're taking one part of Scripture to interpret another part of Scripture to modify or at least ameliorate the possibility of inconsistency and contradiction. Now, you think to yourself, yeah, okay, so that's a Jewish technique, but it's actually a Christian technique as well. Because I don't know how you grew up in your church environment, but in my church environment, the fundamental rule of exegesis was the Bible is the interpretive structure for itself. So you use one verse to interpret another verse. That's why we can go to Galatians and use Romans to interpret it, because we just pick and choose wherever we want from Scripture, because after all, God is the author of the whole thing. And it really could have all been written in one day if God wanted to, because it all has the same ideas. That's the general concept, okay? Now, what you discover is Judaism and Christianity have the same fundamental concept, that it doesn't matter where you take the verses from, they all have to match up. right? So where do you suppose Christianity got the idea that the Bible is used to interpret the Bible? They got it from these guys. They got it from the rabbis who were using Midrash to interpret difficult passages by using other passages, regardless of their chronological position, right? Okay? So Christianity does exactly the same thing, and we would have, and frankly, I would object to both. You can't read the letter of James and interpret it in terms of John's vision at the end of the apostolic material, right? You're not allowed to do that if you're going to be correct, because there's development of idea. But from a theological perspective, since the theology says it's one God who's behind it all, you can reach out anywhere you want and interpret it as you wish. Okay? And what Schiffman points out is, without that flexibility, you're going to end up with inconsistencies and contradictions, and the religion is going to falter. You have to have a way, a systematic way, to interpret the ambiguous and difficult texts so that they fit into the religious context. And the rabbis did that through Midrash, and the Christians do it through interpreting one text in terms of another. Okay? So, he goes on. Oh, and by the way, you can see that it's called Halakha. And why is it called Halakha instead of Agadah? Because Halakha is binding. It's obligatory. It's not just the rabbi's opinion. A rabbi's opinion doesn't help me, because I want to know what is the truth. And so I have Halakha, which says, this is what Moses really meant, right? When it comes to pushing the button on the elevator on Shabbat in Jerusalem, this is what Moses meant, right? The fact that Moses couldn't even have conceived of an elevator doesn't make any difference, because Halakha says, in light of these passages, this is how it should be interpreted. It's obligatory. It's binding. It's not just my opinion. And by the way, Paul uses both Halakha and Agadah, especially in his letter to the Corinthians, where he'll say, and it's my opinion, this is not from the Lord. What he's saying is, this is just how I feel about it. And then he'll go back and say, but these things are binding. So he's being a rabbi. He's being exactly a Midrashic rabbi. And by the way, one more thing. My friend Bob Gorlick had a long discussion with a Christian exegete one time of the book of Hebrews, which is filled with all this stuff about the temple, right? Remember that? And Bob said to him, after there was a long discussion, Bob said to him, don't you understand? The book of Hebrews is Midrash. In other words, it's not designed to give you doctrinal clarity. It's designed to explain where all of these different ideas come from and make them consistent. Okay, so let's go to the next quote. The term Midrash designates both an exegetical method and a collection of literary materials based on Midrashic exegesis. So if you go to the Talmud, you'll find Midrash in there, and you will find not just the verse, but all of the stories, debate, argument, conclusions about the verse, all stretched over hundreds of years. Okay? And now look at the next quote. It's just three words. A rewritten Bible. This is so important, because what it means is the rabbis, in their use of Midrash, actually rewrite the text, right? In the same way that Christians rewrite the text according to their doctrinal bias, so that we change the way that the words, that we change the syntax. I showed you years ago in the book of Revelation how the English Bible actually changes the syntax, the word order, in order to get a doctrine across. Sometimes we change a Greek word, or we leave it out, or we put one in, right? The Midrashic technique of the Jews is exactly the same. They're rewriting the scripture in order to fit a certain way of understanding the text. Okay?
Where do we go from there?
What?
Where do we go from there? How do you?
Ah, yes. Hang on. We'll get to the end. It'll only take another couple of weeks. No, you're right. I mean, the whole point is, yes, it's sort of like, oh my gosh, is there nothing certain? I mean, look what's happening. We're discovering, as we look at the history of the ideas, and this is the important point. See, we're not doing doctrine now. We're not doing We're not doing theology. We're looking at the history of the ideas. Where did the idea come from? And as we look at that history, we're discovering that there's a whole bunch of human manipulation and modification in order to fit a religious system. In other words, the rabbis make a choice and then they massage the text to fit the choice. Okay? But that's no different than Christian doctrine, which it massages the text into proof texts so that they can support their doctrinal ideas. The point is, the commitment to the idea comes first, not after the text, right? It comes before the text, so that the text is read in terms of the Midrash or in terms of the doctrine. I don't go to the text sort of in a neutral position and say, okay, you know, what does this text mean? I go to the text with a preconceived idea of my religious experience, my background, my tradition, my culture, my language, my native tongue, etc. All that I bring to the text. And then I read the text even unconsciously, not recognizing that what's going on until I start exploring this idea, the history of the idea. Where did the idea come from? And now what I discover is Midrash, which is so crucial to the Jewish understanding of its own tradition, developed as an idea in the post-exilic period, right? The idea came from post-Babylon, okay? Just like in the Western world, I want to know where the idea of a political entity comes from, and I have to go back to 5th century BC Athens, right? The ideas start there. So once I understand where the ideas start, now I can see how they evolved, how they developed. And that's what we're trying to do with Schiffman. We want to see, remember what is the title of his book? From Text to Tradition, right? So you begin with the text, but the text isn't enough because the text talks about some tribe wandering on the desert following sheep. What does that have to do with me, right? I need to know what to do today, as you said, Phyllis. What do we do now, right? It's no good to think that we're going to, you know, go to the desert of sin and wait for God to tell somebody to, you know, to speak to a rock to get water. It doesn't work that way anymore. We need the text to become part of our own world. Remember what Aykroyd said? Without the flexibility of interpretation, the religion dies, okay? So now we're going back and we're saying, okay, how is it that Judaism is still alive today, 4,000 years after it started? It's because of what happens in the development of these ideas. Okay? Now, let's look at, and so we're going to talk a lot more about this as we get closer to Schiffman stuff. And when we get to Christine Hayes, you're going to see it all over the place and how it alters the way that we think about the world. But right now, just hang on to that idea and we'll just keep following this and see how Schiffman develops this. Okay? So let's look at the next citation. Chronicles is, in our view, and he's talking about 1st and 2nd Chronicles and probably 1st and 2nd Kings, okay? In other words, the narrative historical text is, in our view, to be seen as an independent work which was not written by the author of Ezra and Nehemiah. It should be dated shortly after the time of Ezra, okay? Composed in the first half of the 4th century BCE, probably at the beginning of the century. Why is this important? Because what does Chronicles talk about? It talks about Saul, David, Solomon, and the kings. Samuel, you know, all those guys. So what he's saying is, that, by the way, those historical events supposedly occurred in the 10th and the 9th centuries BCE. And what he's saying is, it probably was written 500 years later. Why? Because there's a political agenda behind Chronicles and Kings, not because it was written as history. You know, in the ancient world, no one wrote history the way that we understand history today. A recording of the chronology of events. No one wrote it like that. So we have to look at that biblical narrative and say, okay, well, wait a minute. What's the agenda for a people where these stories are now 500 years old? Okay? He says, Chronicles shows how the ancient past of Israel remained at the center of Judean consciousness as the Persian era, not the Persian ear, sorry, as the Persian era drew to a close. So what he's saying is this. Remember what happens. Ezra comes back to reestablish Jerusalem and basically get Israel off the ground again. Okay? And in that process, the covenant relationship with God is reestablished with the discovery of the scroll. And in that process, the whole history of Israel, which underlies the monarchy of David, the priority of Judah, and the relationship of all the other tribes to what will eventually become an apocalyptic view of the world, okay? All of that starts after the Babylonian captivity. In other words, according to what Schiffman is saying and others, right? Those documents were written for political justification. They were written 500 years later, and the stories massaged to give political justification to what was happening after the reestablishment of Jerusalem following the Babylonian captivity. Okay. Now look what he says in the next citation. The phenomenon of prophecy was part of Judaism's Near Eastern heritage. It depended on the feeling of the immediacy of God and his presence that is so much in evidence in the religion of the Hebrew Bible. In other words, look what he just said. You need why do you need the prophets? If Ezra comes back and reestablishes everything, well, who cares about the prophets? They're the ones who were decrying Israel's collapse, right? Why do you need them? Because you need a continuity between what Moses experiences and what's happening by the time of Ezra. And that continuity comes through the prophetic material. You need a line of prophets so that you can show that God has always been interested and present in Israel. Okay? He goes on. As Greek and other foreign cultures came to exercise greater influence on Jews, such ideas began to seem odd. With the coming of Alexander the Great and the sweeping changes that followed in his wake, prophecy ceased altogether. Now that's really interesting, isn't it? Because what he's saying is prophecy didn't end because of the Babylonian captivity. What he's saying is prophecy ended because it became out of date, right? Because Hellenism, the ideas of Hellenism replaced the ideas of a prophetic chain of people going back to Sinai, right? In other words, basically what he's saying is the Greek influence of Hellenism changed the way that we think about our relationship with God, and it changed the way for Jews as well. They no longer look toward a prophet to bring them a message from God. They now started down the path of rational thinking about God, which is a Hellenistic idea. Okay? So did you never ask yourself, well, wait a minute, how come there aren't any prophets after Malachi, after Hosea, after Zechariah? How come there's no prophets when the people come back from the Babylonian captivity? How come there's not another chain of prophets all connected again? And what Schiffman is pointing out is there was a change in the intellectual understanding of the relationship between God and men.
Okay? Skip?
Yes.
Except here in America, they're a dime a dozen. They're all over the place.
Yes, but understand that contemporary ideas of prophet have nothing to do with the ancient world's view of prophet.
Yep.
Prophets today are basically, they're focused on eschatological interpretation. The prophets of the past never had that view. The prophets of the past were basically critics of social responsibility. Right? Think about it. And you know this from Kaufman, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, all the minor prophets. What's their message to Israel? You're messing up. you aren't treating your social responsibilities appropriately. Your royalty is out of touch with what God really intends. You as a nation aren't fulfilling what God's purposes were. It's all about the critical relationship between God and Israel's purpose. But you don't find that today. You don't find that since the third century of the Common Era, when prophecy became a Christian idea. Because prophecy as a Christian idea is eschatological. It's about what you have to do in order to be saved before the end. Right? But completely different idea. Yes.
But the prophets got messages from God. So God was keeping them working, so to speak. So are we saying that that God just stopped talking to a person who would be a prophet? Or?
I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that God stopped talking. I'm saying that Judaism stopped listening. Right? Because they didn't expect God to show up in the line of prophets anymore. They expected that because of what Schiffman is saying is because of the influence of Hellenism, what took over in religion was rational explanation, not prophetic insight.
Okay? So you're saying that you're saying that the person that would be a prophet, if he would be one, he doesn't hear anymore. Basically,
I'm not saying that the prophet doesn't hear. I'm saying that the expectation of the culture is that God will communicate to us through the study of Torah, through the Talmud, through the argumentation and the Midrash, and through all the religious leaders. There's no expectation that God's going to send somebody from the outer fringes of the goat herding or the sheep herding, and who's going to come on the scene and blast forth God's message to men. In fact, when Yeshua does that, they have a big problem with him, right? Not because of what he says, but because prophets were no longer the accepted way that God would communicate with his people. What was the accepted way? The study of Torah, the yeshiva. The interaction of the rabbis, the debate, the midrash, that's how God communicated. After Ezra reestablishes the foundation of the five books of Moses, there's a huge shift in the way that we understand our religious communication with God, right? And certainly after the temple is destroyed, a huge shift because Israel today isn't running around looking for prophets. Israel in the first century wasn't running around looking for prophets. It wasn't wringing its hands saying, oh God, will you send us another prophet? It wasn't saying that. It was saying, we need to turn to the rabbis and the sages because what they said will help us interpret what God wants us to know.
So right? Because they were not looking for it, they just stopped existing?
No, I'm not saying that either. I'm saying that even if there were prophets, and there were, right? Because Yeshua is treated as a prophet by the general population. In the Bar Kokhba revolt, Akiva, it talks about the prophetic. I mean, look, we even have it in the apostolic writings that several people came forward as quote unquote messiahs. Okay. Right. Anointed ones. That's there. Okay. What I'm saying is that the religious culture, the ordinary population of Galilee might have been thrilled because here comes a guy who can heal people and he speaks like Moses would speak, et cetera, et cetera. But what did the religious aristocracy say? Right? He can't be from God. He must be from the devil. Because why? Because God doesn't communicate that way? No, because God's communication to us now comes through the study of Torah, comes through the yeshiva, comes through the midrash, comes through the rabbis. It doesn't come by some itinerant guy showing up from the backwoods giving us a message, right? There's an entire shift in the way that God communicates, not because God changed his mind, not because there weren't prophets anymore, but because the religious aristocracy viewed the relationship with God completely differently after the Babylonian captivity, right? It became a matter of study, not a matter of listening.
Escape.
Right? Yes.
So are you saying that God has adapted his ways of talking to people according to their own cultural change? Is that what you're saying?
Okay, let me think. I'm not saying that God, I believe that God adapts to the way that we understand our culture? Yes. Do I think that that's what happened with Israel? I'm not sure. See, what I'm saying is, and this is the point that Schiffman's making, that Hellenism had a much bigger influence than we originally thought, because it changed the way that we think about our relationship to God. It wasn't simply a matter of a theological difference. It was a matter of how does God communicate with us? And in Hellenism, God communicates through rational understanding. Okay? When we get to Christine Hayes' book, we're going to see this in big, bold letters, because there's a huge difference between what happens in the Hellenistic world and what happens in the Jewish Orthodox world, the Jewish traditional world. Okay?
Skip.
By the way, this isn't happening everywhere. The Pharisees are still arguing for traditional understanding, but the Sadducees, who control the religious aristocracy, are moving in a different direction. So all this is happening at the same time. Right? The question is, and what Shipman is trying to point out is, where do these ideas start? Where did they come from?
Right? Skip.
Yes.
Skip. One observation or question I have, you know, when you're talking about, you know, Hellenism introduced the concept of rationalism into the equation. And would you agree or disagree that that is where we as Christians, quote unquote, coming out of all these different Christian traditions, you know, that's what the rationalism, you know, that has been instilled in us through that process is what drives us to look for certainty. We have to have
absolutely.
Certainty.
You're absolutely correct. Christianity is institutionalized Hellenism, because fundamentally Christianity is a rationally based religion. That's why you can have Aquinas giving you five arguments for the proofs of God, proofs of the existence of God, right? Does Judaism bother with proofs for the existence of God? No. Because Judaism is essentially a revealed religion. Remember that? Okay? We read that statement the last time. A revealed religion. What's the difference? A revealed religion asks you to be obedient. A Hellenistic religion asks you to think. Okay? So, ultimately, Christianity is a religion of thought. It's to correct your thinking about God, whereas Judaism is, from a Mosaic perspective, a religion about obedience. It doesn't ask you to think it through. It doesn't even ask you to understand it. It just says, this is what you have to do, right? But Christianity doesn't stop there. Christianity says, well, if we're going to do this, we need to know why. And that we need to know why is the rational basis of the Christian faith. Right? That's why we have apologetics, with all these guys running around trying to give you evidence for why you should believe. But Judaism doesn't do that, does it? You don't find any books, you know, Paul Little's Know Why You Believe. You don't find Jewish books like that. You find Jewish books about their tradition, but it doesn't explain why you should believe that. It just says, this is what we believe. Right? That's the fundamental difference. And what Schiffman is pointing out is, after the Babylonian captivity, when Hellenism now is spreading its way across the Mediterranean world, Hellenism is Greek thinking, Greek rational-based thinking, okay? When it's spreading its way across the world, it's influencing the way that the rabbis treat the text, the tradition, and their understanding with God. And as they do that, they shift from a prophetic, revealed religion to a study-based religion. And the study-based religion is rational thinking about how God interacts. Okay?
That's why John the Baptist, if you brought him out here today, people would probably put him in a mental institution.
Of course. Right.
And Skip, it makes me think about a scripture where in Ezekiel it talks about the pillow prophets, which when they went into exile, God said, you know, those are the ones that I did not send. Don't listen to them. as opposed to Yeshua lamenting what they did to the prophets, and so did God.
Yes.
Was always saying, you know, look what you did to the prophets. You stoned the prophets I sent.
Yes. Okay, but now think about this, right? Think about contemporary Judaism, okay? Especially rabbinic Judaism, okay? In rabbinic Judaism today, is there a cry for God to send a new prophet so that we'll understand what he wants us to do in the modern world? No.
Mm-mm.
What is there? There's a reinterpretation of the traditional text through Midrash in the Talmud to understand how we apply what God already revealed. We're not asking for new revelation. The Jewish community isn't asking for a new prophet. As far as they're concerned, the prophets have come and gone. What we want to know is, what did they say, which is the question of how do we interpret the text, okay? Now, let me just make this point, and this is important. Islam, which is also a fundamentally based, written kind of revealed religion, has this one difference. That is that the latest imam is in fact the mouthpiece of God's interpretation of the traditional text, no matter what the traditional text used to say. So Islam is as current as the last proclamation of the existing imam. Okay? It constantly changes. And in fact, it changes so much that the imam can say, well, this is what it says in the Quran, but this is what it actually means. Right? Okay? So you have those kinds of huge changes occurring after Babylon because of the influence of what was happening in the Mediterranean world. Okay, let's go to his quote on Zechariah. Zechariah saw strange visions and related them to the people along with his interpretation of these experiences. His visions helped to shape the later apocalyptic text of Judaism and Christianity. Okay, why is this important? Because first century Judaism in a messianic world was apocalyptic, right? And the patterns and the visions that belong to the prophets are reinterpreted and incorporated into the apocalyptic material of the New Testament and ultimately work their way into Christianity. Right? So he says in the next citation, the book of Zechariah is an important transition from the prophecies of the biblical period to the apocalyptic writings of the Second Temple period. So do I still have prophecy in the Second Temple period? Of course, but it's prophecy now that's moved, not in relation to God's message for me today, but what will happen in the future. Apocalyptic prophecy. End times is what Christianity interpreted as. Okay? All right. Now he's going to shift a little bit. Next citation. There's no evidence at all for the oft-repeated view that the scriptures were formally canonized at Yavne. While virtually all of the writings were regarded as canonical by the time of the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE, arguments continued regarding the status of Proverbs, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. Why is this important? Because what it says is that the fixed idea of biblical books that were the fundamental books of Judaism is still not the case when the Second Temple was destroyed in 70 CE. In other words, Christianity developed a canon before Judaism did. And that's what he says in the next citation. It was the decision of the Christians to reopen the canon for a moment and to place the New Testament within it one of the basic disagreements separating Judaism from Christianity. In other words, I've said this before, the Christians co-opted the Jewish text of the Hebrew Bible, added the apostolic materials, and claimed that they had the Word of God before the Jews had finished with their process of canonization. So the Jewish response is, you can't canonize our scriptures and make them yours. We have to have a canon of our own. But that happens way after most of the New Testament is already written, right? So what does that tell me? The believing community of the first century had a great deal more flexibility in their understanding of sacred material than we do, or than what Judaism today does. And we know that's the case from our examination of Enoch and the Testament of the Twelves and the Assumption of Moses and all the other stuff that goes on that was part of the sacred community. We have, in essence, a very truncated view of what sacred texts really were, right? Even in the first century, in the Christian world, the letters of Clement were accepted as sacred, right? It wasn't until the councils following Eusebius that we had a, you know, firm, fixed list of books. But the point is, the early believing community had this much wider view of what God was trying to say through all of these other documents that we know most of us no longer even read. Okay? So let's take a look at the next longer quote here. Greek culture had by this time developed to its pinnacle. It had been liberated from the limitations of geography, right? This is the reign of Alexander the Great spreads Hellenism across the entire Mediterranean world all the way to India. So geographical boundaries are no longer part of it. And one could now be a Hellene by education and culture, not just by birth. This is really important because you could become a citizen of the Greek world simply because of your education and your cultural affinity. You didn't have to be born that way. And this is huge because remember what's happening in Judaism. In Judaism, you're Jewish if you're born Jewish, not because you think Jewish, you speak Hebrew, you adopt the Torah. You're Jewish if you're born Jewish. That's the only way you can be Jewish. So along comes Hellenism and says, hey, you can be part of us without being born in Greece, right? You can actually be a Hellene and be born in Constantinople. It doesn't matter. Of course, it wasn't Constantinople in those days, or maybe it was. I don't remember. Okay? You can be born in Spain and be a Hellene. You can be a part of the empire and be a citizen wherever you happen to be geographically, because what matters is your culture and your thinking. Okay? So he goes on. Man now was at the center of the cosmos rather than merely of the polis, a Greek city, as he had been earlier. Concurrently, the native Near Eastern civilizations had run their course and were on the decline. He's talking about Egypt, Persia, Babylon, Assyria. They're all finishing, right? Egypt and Mesopotamia apparently produced little of literary or intellectual import in this period, and the widespread interest in new religions observable in the sources indicates a hunger for new means of spiritual fulfillment, right? This is why Paul can go to the Areopagus and say, I see that you're religious men, okay? The time was ripe for a new cultural movement. Thus, the peoples of the defeated Persian Empire could offer no more resistance to the Hellenic culture onslaught than they had to the Macedonian army. The Greek city, known as the Polis, was the vehicle for the assimilation and Hellenization of the indigenous peoples of the Near East. And that spread all the way through Judaism, right? The great study by Martin Hengel, Judaism and Hellenism, a fantastic work on the influences of Hellenism in Jewish thinking in between the 4th century BCE and the 1st century, right? He goes on. Yet the indigenous peoples did not simply absorb the Hellenic and the Hellenistic. They redefined and reinterpreted their own traditional cultures in light of the modern civilization which they now found themselves, okay? And that's really important because you don't see in rabbinic Judaism a wholesale embrace of Hellenistic rationalism. What you see is a reinterpretation, a massaging of the traditional methods that allow Hellenism to be incorporated into Judaism without conversion, right? Okay? And he goes on, next paragraph. the language and culture of the rural peasantry remained Hebraic, and Hellenism tended to influence them only in the area of material culture. What he's basically saying is this: if you wanted to trade your fish, you had to speak Greek. Okay? But otherwise, if you lived in the Galilee, you didn't have much to do with Hellenism, because what the centers of Hellenism were in the centers of population: Jerusalem, Caesarea, all the places where there was a major Greek influence. Okay? So we now see, as a result of this, a divide in the population of Israel itself. The ordinary peasant population, the mass of just ordinary people, and the elite, the aristocrats, who are moving more and more in the direction of Hellenism. Right? Why? Because they have to fit into an environment that's saturated with this Greco-Roman idea. Okay? So he says, beginning in the late 2nd century BCE, extreme Hellenizers of the type previously known only in the Greek cities gained control of the Jerusalem priesthood and attempted to transform Jerusalem into another Hellenistic polis. This event set the stage for the Maccabean Revolt. Okay? So you can see, the Maccabean Revolt doesn't happen because of religious ideas. It happens because of the conflict between Hellenism and traditional Jewish understanding. Okay? It's a cultural issue. So, he goes on. The persecutions were enacted in the winter of 167-166 BCE. To begin with, the decree of Antiochus III, which had granted the Jews extensive rights of religious freedom, was formally rescinded. Moreover, in December of 167, foreign idolatrous worship and cultic prostitution were introduced into the temple. Those are Hellenistic ideas, right? In addition, throughout Palestine, the Sabbath and the festivals were to be violated. High places, outdoor shrines, were built where unclean animals were to be offered. Circumcision was outlawed, and the dietary laws could not be observed. So everything that was traditional about Jewish practice and worship came into conflict with this Hellenistic push that came into Jerusalem. Okay? So I have this next little quote. The Egyptian priest Manetho, in the reign of Ptolemy II Philadelphus, 283 to 246 BCE, may be credited with being the author of the first known anti-Semitic tract. Why? Because the push of the Hellenistic culture was attempting to paint Jewish traditional beliefs as anti-civilization, right? These guys were barbarians because of circumcision and their dietary restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Hellenes wanted to brand them in a way so that people would reject what the Jews were doing. And remember, this is after a long period of basically allowing people to worship in it whatever way they wanted. When Hellenism started to be practiced as a political event, then these people who took over the aristocracy in Jerusalem and who were Hellenistic began to push back against the Jews. Okay, so he summarizes this. Virtually all diaspora Jews were members of the Jewish communal organization termed the Greek either politima, political body, citizens, katakia, designation for a separate settlement of body of residence within a city, or synagogue, community. The Jews were organized into autonomous bodies of this kind because they were seen as foreigners born abroad, right? Other ethnic groups in the Hellenistic world were similarly organized either as foreign ethnic communities or as religious corporations. So there's lots of these. All such organizations required royal permits and, in the case of the Jewish community, were guaranteed the right to conduct their affairs in accordance with their ancestral laws. Thus, The Jewish communities had complete freedom to build synagogues, to set up independent courts of justice and other institutions, to educate their youth in tradition and elect their own officials, as long as, and we can add this caveat, they didn't create civil unrest and they were compliant with the economic demands of the empire. Okay? So what happens? The Jewish Hellenizers, who start to create a Hellenistic polis in Jerusalem, created civil unrest because they came into conflict with this traditional culture. And in the process of civil unrest, it affected the economic stability of the region. And when it affects the economy and the political stability, the empire gets involved. And when the empire gets involved, they came down as a result of anti-Semitic propaganda, they came down on the Jews and forced them to eliminate their traditional practices because they believed that that's what was causing all this instability. So he continues, the process of Hebraization can be observed in later Roman and Byzantine periods as Hellenistic Judaism was pulled into two contradictory directions, toward Palestinian Tanaitic Judaism on the one hand, and toward assimilation into the Christianized Roman world on the other. Okay? So here's the summary. This stuff started in 250 years before Yeshua. For 250 years, conflict was going on in terms of the contrast between the Hellenistic culture and the Jewish traditional beliefs. Some of that time, it was like a Cold War, right? A mutual agreement not to create conflict. But when conflict occurred, the empire, whatever the empire happened to be at that point, stepped in and started restricting the way that Jews could act. As a result of that, it became more and more intense till the Maccabean Revolt, and then following the Maccabean Revolt, even more intense until we get to 70 CE, when the Romans finally say, that's enough, we're not going to have this instability in our political system anymore. Okay? But in that process, it drives Jews in two directions. One, toward Palestinian Tanaitic Judaism, which ultimately becomes modern Judaism. And the other, toward Christianized Judaism, which becomes the Roman Catholic Church. So the separation occurs initially because of cultural differences that force the religious practice to be dealt with in two different ways. Okay? And Hellenism is the background to this. Had Hellenism not occurred, the Jews would have continued in their traditional worship practices and never seen any change, right? There wouldn't have been the need for, there wouldn't have been the need for Rome to clamp down on what was happening that upset the political stability. Had Hellenism not influenced Judaism, had Judaism maintained its separate identity from Hellenistic thinking, none of that would have happened, okay? Okay, let's look one more quote, or two more quotes on this. Okay. A more serious threat to traditional Judaism came from philosophically oriented Jews who explained the Torah as an allegory and therefore maintained that the commandments did not have to be observed. Oh my gosh, does that sound familiar or what? Philo Judaeus, the Alexandrian, forcefully objected to this approach. All in all, the Judaism of the Greco-Roman diaspora set patterns of communal organization that would carry Jews through the next 2,000 years. The collapse of Hellenistic culture and the rise of Christianity ultimately led to its decline. Yet in its heyday, Hellenistic Judaism was vibrant and committed. Its strength is best demonstrated by the many semi-proselytes who flock to its institutions, and by the rich culture. I got an extra B in there. And by the rich literature it left. Okay? And we need to read the next paragraph. Anti-Semitism has two basic features. One is economic, and social, and the other, the motif of Jew as Christ killer. Okay? So, while the second quite obviously had to await the rise of Christianity to begin its ignominious career, the economic and social aspects began to surface in the Hellenistic diaspora. Judaism was regarded as a barbarous superstition. Why? Because what we've seen happen. Remember, Judaism is ultimately a revealed religion where the commandments of God are not questioned but simply obeyed. Hellenism is a rational approach where we question why something is the case, and if it doesn't make sense to us, we don't obey it. And those two things came into huge conflict with each other, and where they came into conflict, where people were arguing back and forth and willing to go to fight over them, it created political unrest and economic unrest, and the result was the rise of anti-Semitism. And then he makes this final statement, which we're going to we'll end with today, because now we're going to start talking about another topic. Yet anti-Semitism seems to transcend history, and no explanation suffices to explain it. Okay? So what he's saying is this. We can give the rationale, the economic, the social, political, the religious background to why anti-Semitism develops. But in the final analysis, anti-Semitism is an irrational hatred. It doesn't actually have any real sense behind it. It's somehow the communication of a hatred based on race, right, that goes beyond any rational explanation. Right? You can see the same thing happening today, and not just in terms of Jewish thinking. You can see it starting to happen all over the place, where cultures are now being divided over irrational hate. Right? In America, Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is, when you think about it, irrational. Because of course Black Lives Matter, but so does every other life. Why is it that suddenly this becomes an opportunity to systematically develop a standard of hate toward somebody who doesn't have the same skin color? I mean, it's irrational, but it's no more irrational than anti-Semitism, which has been going on for thousands of years, and that's why Schiffman can say, there isn't any rational explanation for this. It's somehow propagated and perpetrated by this irrational kind of emotion. It doesn't even have any basis in history or evidence or anything else. It just is there. Okay? Now, we're going to transition now into a discussion of canon and books and how the process occurs. And so I'm going to stop now. We can talk about any of the things that we brought up so far, but I want you to recognize that, you know, Schiffman is talking about where did the ideas come from? And these ideas all have history, and we can trace them back, like anti-Semitism, to this first anti-Semitic tract in 246 BCE. And we can see how the ideas develop. In particular, we're interested in the way that the rabbinic culture and the rabbinic exegetical process changed. But now you can see how these ideas were influenced by what happened after the Babylonian captivity. Things occurred, changes in the political and social world occurred that affected Judaism for the rest of its existence up to today. Right? And certainly was present in the first century when we get to, the apostolic material. Okay. Anybody else want to make a comment before we stop for today?
Yes. Hey, Skip?
Yeah.
Wasn't it similar to what the Pharaoh did to the Hebrews in the beginning part of the Exodus, where basically he wanted to get the people to turn against the Hebrews? So what he did is created the idea that they were clean, they were dirty, they were vicious, they were against us.
Yeah. And by the way, that they were economically suppressing other people, which we still see today in anti-Semitism, right? The Jews control the banking system, they control this, they control that, yeah. And all of my economic problems are because of them. Pharaoh uses the same tack, right?
Yeah,
same idea. Yeah, so it's the repetition occurs civilization to civilization, right? Of course, in Pharaoh's time, it wasn't anti-Semitism because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Semites he was after. It was Hebrews, right? It was the Hebrews were the problem. So it's anti-Hebraic. Any other comments? Give you enough to think about until next week?
Hi, Skip.
All right. Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment and just express, are we not looping today? Have we not been looping from the beginning of time when we were given free choice of our creator to choose him? And we've revolted, of course, over the millennium in doing that. So we're looping for control in this world. But for me, my foundation is God, is our creator, as it is, I'm sure, with all of us. And that's where I have to draw my power and my source from, in looking at everything that's happened in the past and what we're going through today is exactly what the world has been doing from the beginning when we rejected God. Is this not?
Yeah, I think that, yeah? That certainly, we can certainly view it that way. I think what, in the broadest brush stroke, that's exactly right. We're right back in Genesis chapter 3, right? There's no question about that. But what I think is important is that as we look at the details of how this historical development occurred, we will be able to see deeper into, I hope, our own participation unconsciously in the very things that undermine the tradition that started with Moses at Sinai, right? And by the time, listen, if you can hang on, by the time we get to Hayes's book on what makes the divine law divine, we're going to see so many assumptions that we have made that are really based in a Greco-Roman system that we weren't even aware of, but it's just so much a part of our culture that when it's actually put in print in front of us, we'll be shocked and say, oh my gosh, I never realized that I'm actually part of that, right? And that's one of the things that has to come out of a study like this. We want to reflect on where the ideas came from, because ultimately those ideas become part of me. Why? Because I was born in America, in the West, in the 20th century, because I inherited all this stuff. And so now I need to go back and ask myself, why did I inherit that? What made this the way that I understand how the world works? And we're going to see that deeper and deeper as we follow through these guys who are writing about, you know, what happened in the history of this development.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? I agree with you totally. But for me, what it's doing is it's strengthening my base core in the belief of a God that has so wonderfully given us this free choice that we've made such disasters with.
Yeah.
But he's in control. He's there. He's there with us.
Yeah.
That's my belief. That's where my foundation is. I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Skip?
Yeah.
This is David. Going back to part of the notes here, we're talking about when Hellenism was at its peak, that geographical boundaries were removed and you no longer had to be a citizen of a specific geographical area to be part of
it. You didn't have to be born. It's not citizenship. Right. Birth.
Right.
Birth.
Okay? Right. Would you say that it's analogous with Paul's approach, that he may have used that as a paradigm? Now you don't have to be a Jew. You know, you don't have to
absolutely. You can see that Paul is, in that regard, he's modeling a Hellenistic idea. Why? Because he's writing to Gentiles. And one of the things that you know about ancient religions is they belong. You remember when we were talking about Peter Acolytes, right? Ancient religions are family-based religions, right? You have to be a member of the clan in order to have this particular kind of God, okay? So what does Paul say? No, you don't have to be born Jewish. You can practice and worship and become part of the culture and be obedient to the commandments. And that's what it means to be Jewish, right? Remember his argument about the slave woman and the free woman and all that kind of stuff that goes on? We need to read that in terms of rabbinic thinking about what was happening in the Hellenistic world. And Paul is a forward thinker in terms of his approach to Gentiles because he's using ideas that they absolutely embrace, right? I can be a Hellenist without being born in Greece. I can be a believer in the Messiah without being born in Israel. There's the same argument that's going on there, and that's how you need to understand what Paul is doing. On the other hand, there are requirements. So when Christianity comes along and says, you can be a Christian because you believe Jesus died for your sins and you don't have to worry about the commandments, Paul could never say that because the fundamentals of being Jewish for Paul were the commandments of Moses and the worship system that God put in place, right? If you change that, then you're not Jewish anymore.
Isn't that ironic, though, that that's basically what is taught at most theological seminaries, is you don't have to put up with any of that Jewish stuff. That's gone. That's done. That's finished.
Right. And by the way, they have to do that in order to justify their division from Judaism. Because, look, if Christian seminaries said, you know what? You have to believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. You have to practice the commandments of Moses. You have to follow the Jewish calendar. People would say, yeah, but I'm Jewish. I'm not Christian. I'm Jewish. Right? What's the difference? So there has to be a difference.
But Paul is such an enigmatic character because even in these theological seminaries, they classify it as Pauline Christianity.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Because Paul is sometimes he acts like a Hellenist. And sometimes he acts like a traditional Jew. So where is that? How do we read him? Okay. Anybody else? Nope. Okay. Well, I'm going to stop the recording then.